For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
There doesn't seem to be, to me, an overall goal, an overall strategy or vision for how the health system in Australia needs to work to provide the best care for the Australian communities.
That's Dr. Simon Judkins, an emergency physician and immediate past president of the Australasian College of Emergency Medicine. On the 26th of April, Insight Plus, the MJA's online news magazine, published an opinion piece written by Dr. Judkins, which detailed the current crisis which is threatening to overwhelm Australia's acute care sector, and it's not COVID-19. That article went viral around the country, with many of Dr. Judkins' colleagues responding with similar evidence of impending, if not imminent, disaster. Simon is my guest today. Hi, Simon. We're talking about overcrowding and access blocking in Australia's emergency departments. Is this a new problem?
From an emergency medicine perspective, and people working in EDs, we've been talking about this for decades. That's just been an ongoing issue, and it's been getting progressively worse. And we're at the point now where it is the worst that it has been ever since I've been doing emergency medicine, as I said in the article, and talking to my colleagues around the country, it is deteriorating. You know, day by day, they see this getting worse. I've had email correspondence from the guys in South Australia, my colleagues in South Australia, WA, Northern Territory, and everywhere. They're saying that this is really, really escalating.
Of course, WA's got that awful case of Aishwarya Aswath, who...
Absolutely.
I think your colleagues have quite rightly, this is a systemic problem that's caused this.
I think this, whenever you look at these cases, you obviously, you know, there's going to be unique and distressingly tragic sort of circumstances, but we have been saying for a long, long time that overcrowded waiting rooms and access block in emergency departments will lead to patient deterioration, increasing morbidity and mortality. And we've said that loud and clear for a very long time. And I've seen this happening in and heard this happening in emergency departments around the country. People don't feel that they are in the situation to really speak up about it because it's their job on the line, you know, whistleblowers. And we've seen plenty of cases, hearing plenty of evidence about patients spending in 8, 9, 10 hours just waiting to be seen, spending 18 hours in a waiting room, fully admitted, but there's no bed in the hospital. And you've got a 76-year-old gentleman with cellulitis on his leg who's waiting for an inpatient bed, but he spent the whole time sitting in the waiting room. You know, it's getting really desperately bad. Of course, you know, we've seen the responses around the tragic death in Victoria of a lady waiting for an ambulance for 8 hours. And most of those ambulances were tied up out the front of hospitals. So these are the things that are happening.
Is this just a public sector problem, or is it happening in the private EDs as well?
Oh, I think it's mainly a public sector issue. I think, you know, one of the problems that we have is that there is an increasing division, I think, in access to healthcare. I think if you've got finances and you can afford to pay, then you'll be able to access care. But if you certainly don't have the financial means, that it becomes very, very difficult to access timely care. Your only source of that acute care is going to be your local hospital emergency department.
How much of this do you attribute to what's been happening in general practice in terms of defunding and the lack of incentives, the corporatisation of GPs, things like that? Is that a significant factor in what you're experiencing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a number of different reasons, it's not just I can't see my GP quickly. And certainly that is a problem, is that our GP colleagues are the bedrock of our health system, and everybody needs to be able to access a GP. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that it often takes days for people to get an appointment if they're acutely unwell. They just can't get in to see their GP. And then it comes to down to affordability. So it's one, the acute thing, I can't see my GP, I'm unwell. Then it's the ongoing maintenance of so people who've got chronic conditions, being able to have regular appointments to see their GP and build that long-term relationship. So I think that is a significant problem. And then it's the lack of funding. And I can completely empathise with my – I was speaking to a GP working in a regional community recently, and she was talking about the impact of having to look after a large cohort of patients with significant mental health problems who don't fit into a 20-minute consultation. Yeah. They can't afford to pay any excess fees, and they take 2 hours to work out. And if you've got one patient in a crisis, then that can almost take up your whole day.
Exactly.
And she was saying at the end of a full day's work, she probably ended up $16 ahead. That's unsustainable. And so that's where I think we need to think about other ways, other innovations, things that we can do differently to fix it. And I think part of this problem is that there is a mixed funding model. Feds pay for one thing, the states pay for something else. Nobody really wants to take accountability for the overall cost. But so there's a lot of cost shifting going on. And see this in aged care, for example. So aged care facilities, we can't get the GPs into those aged care facilities because, again, restrictions on cost. It costs them money to service an aged care facility. They need to take time out. And so now we're seeing this, the public hospital clinicians moving into the aged care sort of system to try and keep people well in those aged care facilities. Now, you know, that's a state-based cost. So there's a lot of shuffling between, and nobody really wants to say, well, economically, it makes much more sense to have GPs and their staff being able to properly service aged care facilities instead of moving the cost between the two systems. In some respects, there are some emergency departments with GP clinics co-located, but I think that's just because the ideal would be to have GP clinics that are open for extended hours who have access to radiology. You know, and that's part of the issue is that, you know, we used to have extended hours bulk billing clinics available in communities. They seem to have disappeared, and now we're going, well, put them into emergency departments. But, you know, that's part of the issue. I think the other big issue that we really face is that the other side of that coin is that we can't get admitted patients into the hospital system. That cohort of GP patients certainly are an issue. I think our GP colleagues need to be able to access patients to keep them well in community, need to be able to refer them to outpatient clinics, need to be able to maintain health in the community. But when one of those patients does become sick and they need hospital admission, we actually can't get them out of the EDs into hospitals. And I've seen, you know, over the last 2 weeks, correspondence from colleagues who are turning up to work and, you know, 40 of their 45 ED beds are taken up by inpatients waiting for hospital admission. And they've been there for 16, 17 hours. In some cases, you know, just looking here at my notes, 24, 48, 76 hours waiting for an inpatient bed.
I'm chatting with Dr. Simon Judkins about the state of emergency medicine in Australia. You can find Simon's original article at insightplus.mja.com.au or by Googling ED overcrowding. The article, like all Insight Plus content, is free to access. You can find all our podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts or at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Drop me a line at cswannell, that's C, S for Sam, W-A-N-N-E-L-L, at mja.com.au with any feedback or suggestions you might have. Back to our chat. So we need more beds.
Well, we need a much more efficient and effective system. I suppose that conversation about how do you create hospital capacity is about, one, the number of beds, but also how do we use those beds? And I think we still have a system that, you know, in all honesty, it still runs Monday to Friday, you know, within working hours. I know, you know, the hospital's a 24-hour system, but, you know, if you're admitted on a Friday evening and you need an echo as part of your workup, it'll be Tuesday before you get it.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole lot of people sitting around within the acute beds waiting for investigations that they should be able to get in a much more timely manner. So that would free up a lot of capacity.
It's all very well to have more beds, but you have to have staff to man those beds, don't you?
Yeah, well, that's right. And so certainly staffing and resources is an issue. But, you know, I think it's frustrating for somebody who's been in the system for some time because every time we get a new executive into a hospital, they say, well, let's do, you know, some time-based flow study capacity thing that they do. Yeah. And they spend a couple of $100,000 getting an external consultant who says, well, the same thing. We just need to move to a seven-day-a-week model where patients can move in and out we don't have this issue where nobody gets discharged on Saturday and Sunday. And every Monday, I mean, emergency physicians and nurses hate Mondays. It's incredibly predictable. It's like Groundhog Day, that every Monday you turn up, your ED will be full. And then those patients are gradually create capacity. And by about Wednesday or Thursday, you start to have a good day, and then the weekend hits again, and then you go through the same thing. So we haven't moved to a seven-day-a-week system because people get sick, apparently,
on
Saturdays
weekends
and Sundays.
Yeah,
it still happens.
Yeah.
We need the system to move. And that, as I said, we haven't managed to change that paradigm in you know, forever.
So wave a magic wand for me, Simon. If you were, I don't know, who is in charge of this? If you were the health minister, what would you do?
I think you made a very valid point there, is who is in charge? I don't know. I'm not sure who's in charge of the system and coordinating the various parts of the system to make it work as effectively as it should be. I mean, we put a lot of money into healthcare, you know, billions of dollars. We all get it. You know, it's a, you know, they talk about the bottomless pit of money, but there is so much waste. You know, Sally McCarthy, who is the now IFM president, but ex-president of ASIM, pointed out in, you know, some email correspondence to me is that, you know, end-of-life care, for example, we are sending a lot of the acute health system to look after people in the last 6 months of their lives. Yeah. Where that care could be delivered in community, it can be delivered in aged care facilities, but the fallback is come to the emergency department and get admitted. So there's nothing more devastating for an emergency physician at, you know, 11 o'clock on a Friday evening to see 10 ambulances lining up, and six of those are patients from aged care facility, a couple have got palliative care issues. They shouldn't have to come to emergency departments to get the care that they need. No. That seems to be the default, and it's really sad and it's really distressing for patients, for the families and for the staff to see that happen. You know, who's in charge? There doesn't seem to be, to me, an overall goal, an overall strategy or vision for how the health system in Australia needs to work to provide the best care for the Australian communities. It was interesting leading into COVID, there was that sort of interconnectedness, wasn't there? People realised that prevention was better than cure. We got homeless people housed. You know, we got, you know, we started with, you know, telehealth and teleconsult. We kept people at home and tried to make sure they could get the care that they needed at home. Yeah. And clearly there were holes in that. We're seeing some of the repercussions, but at least everybody worked together towards a common goal. One of the things I think we really need to focus on, it goes back to, again, the conversation about GPs and community care, is that our health system is very hospital-focused and it's very intervention-focused. When people get sick, they'll get great care if they can get into the hospital system. But we don't do enough about keeping people unwell. Somebody did comment to me that you can be homeless with mental health issues and you cannot get care that you need. But if somebody finds you and you've had a stroke, they'll send a helicopter or an ambulance with a CT scanner in the back of it, and you'll get the amazing cutting-edge care for your acute stroke. But nothing happens before you get to that point in time where you are acutely unwell, and there's so much that could have been done in the prevention space that we just don't do.
There isn't one answer, is there?
Well, I think, again, I think you need to listen to the evidence and you need to listen to the health professionals, and we need to take some of the politics out of healthcare and some of the tribalism out of healthcare. Everybody is lobbying for their own piece of the pie, which is understandable, but if we focused on what's best for the population and what's best for the system, you know, we would go back to making sure that people had access to housing, they had access to food, you know, we're going to save a lot more lives by actually preventing from people getting sick than we are by intervening in the last when they become acutely unwell. And as I said, we're very intervention focused. That's where the sexy sort of part of medicine actually is. You know, the new innovations, politicians getting photographed out the front of hospitals with helicopter pads and all sorts of things. But prevention doesn't seem to be sexy and doesn't necessarily get the headlines. And I think that's got a lot to do with politics and healthcare being very intimately linked, unfortunately.
Thanks for your time, Simon.
No worries. Thank you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts, or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.